Hey, I'm Noam Weissman, and you're listening to Unpacking Israeli History, the podcast that takes a deep dive into some of the most intense, historically fascinating, and often misunderstood events and stories linked to Israeli history. This episode of Unpacking Israeli History is generously sponsored by Sarla and Danny Turkel. Before we start this season, I'm going to say what I constantly say. I want to be in touch, so shoot me an email at noam@jewishunpack.com. Especially in the last few months, the world has exploded, and we need each other. So please email me, talk to me. Also, if you're new to the show, let me remind you of the structure. Number one, I tell the story. Number two, I give you the five fast facts. Number three, I give you one enduring lesson as I see it. And number four, I read correspondence with listeners. You ready? Welcome to season six. Yalla, let's do this.
על הקמת מדינה יהודית בארץ ישראל, היא מדינת ישראל.
We, the people of Israel, are prepared and anxious to meet the representatives of our neighbors without any preconditions.
There are people in Israel and elsewhere say it's impossible to make peace between the Arabs and Israel or the Jewish people. I think they are wrong.
You know, when I first became a dad, I was convinced that I'd be one of the cool ones. I was young, I was hip. I named my kid Eyal after a charming spy on a TV show. And if you're like, Noam, what? Go back and listen to our episode on the Mossad, and you'll see how my wife tricked me into that one. She's a sneaky one, eh? But as my kids get older, they make one thing abundantly clear. There's no such thing as a cool dad. Sorry, guys. You should see my daughter's reactions when I dance. I lift up my arms and pump like a Jersey boy just to watch my daughters cringe. And they cringe every single time. But I get it. Eventually, we all buy a pair of unflattering jeans, pull up our white socks as high as they can go, and tell the worst jokes in the world. So that's how I'm going to start this episode, with a joke that was probably outdated when my dad was a kid. Lean in, right? Okay, so the joke starts with God creating the world. It's incredible. He makes rainforests and deserts and icebergs and mountains. He makes Victoria Falls. He makes that insane underwater cave in the Philippines. Seriously, Google it. It's gorgeous. He makes Australia. Ever been to Australia? Place is sick. Bondi Beach? Holy Lord. And then he tells the angels he's making a special place. It's going to be the holiest place on earth, with mountains and beaches and pure water springs and a sea filled with healing minerals, not to mention the milk and honey. And he's going to give it to one particular group of humans. The angels are like, hold up, this sounds too good to be true. You sure these humans deserve it? And why them? Won't the rest of the world get jealous? But God just smiles and says, guys, come on, I'm God. You think I don't think about these things? Of course I do. I've installed a fail-safe mechanism to keep the humans humble. And the angels are like, oh my gosh. They don't say, oh my God, because that would be rude. You're amazing, genius. What's the secret? And God smiles again, this time a little more wickedly. And he says, wait till you see the neighbors. Hey, it's a classic old man at shul, church, mosque joke. But you know what? There's some truth to it. Because Israel is amazing, warts and all. And it is also in a very tough neighborhood. Just no two ways to slice that one. We've talked at length about the neighbors, about the 1948 war between newly minted Israelis and basically the entire Arab world, about the two front lines of the Yom Kippur War in 73, about endless terror attacks from the north and the south, and of course, we've devoted a whole lot of time to Hamas, who won the competition for Israel's worst neighbor on October 7th, 2023. Da-na-na, da-na-na. That was my SportsCenter da-na-na noise. Yes, links for all of this in the show notes. But until that horrible day, the competition was stiff. What with Palestinian Islamic Jihad and the Lion's Den and, oh yeah, the super powerful, well-funded militia on Israel's northern border. Any guesses? Okay, I'll tell you. That would be Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia terror group founded, trained, and funded by Iran. Hezbollah and Israel have fought some pretty nasty wars over the past 40-some years. And as I record this, in February of 2024, I hate to say that all signs point to another skirmish and then some. Now, I hope I'm wrong. I hope we can maintain at least our current uneasy status quo. I hope that this episode won't become heartbreakingly relevant the way our Hamas episode did just 4 months after we released it in 2023. But one thing is clear. No one knows exactly what's going to happen. and it's almost impossible for ordinary folks to prepare for the unknown. All we can do is try to understand, who is Hezbollah? What do they want? And is there any hope in this grim situation at all? So let me tell you, Hezbollah, all the different pronunciations, is a Lebanese group, but their story doesn't actually start in Lebanon. In fact, their story doesn't start until midway through this episode. Resist the Gen Z millennial temptation to get all your info in 30 seconds or less. We'll get there. That's because to fully understand the conditions under which the militia was born, or the terrorist group, depending on your perspective, you have to understand a couple of massive geopolitical events. So bear with me as I take you into Iran, Jordan, Lebanon, and Israel. I promise it'll all lead back to Hezbollah. And the cool thing about this episode is you're going to really get it all. Let's get into the history. Our first stop is 1970s Iran.
Israel and Tehran were suddenly like millionaires.
שיתוף הפעולה עם ישראל היה אדיר.
מי לימד אותם חקלאות? מי הקים להם את כל הסחרים הכי גדולים?
בנינו להם מדינה.
It'll never cease to amaze me that Israel and Iran were once allies. You heard that right, allies. We're talking a significant Israeli expat community and daily flights between Tehran and Tel Aviv. Bananas. Like Savannah Bananas. By the way, low-key, the Savannah Bananas have totally hacked the social media game. Good for them. Really cool for them. But anyway, but like really bananas. You can learn way more about this from some links in the show notes, but seriously, crazy. But 1970s Iran was far from utopia. True, the country's king, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, was a reformer, and Iran experienced massive economic growth during his reign. He invested that money wisely in education. Literacy rates skyrocketed. Women earned the right to vote, and some minority groups thrived, including Iran's Jews. Though they made up less than a quarter of a percent of Iranian society, their community was broadly speaking wealthy and vibrant enough to support multiple Jewish schools, social institutions, and synagogues. In fact, there are more than 30 synagogues in Tehran alone. It was basically Teaneck, New Jersey. Sorry, that might be a deep cut. But there was trouble brewing under the surface. The Shah may have ushered in a new age for Iran, but the wealth was not divided equally. The gap between rich and poor, urban and rural, widened significantly. But if you happen to comment on Iran's massive income inequality, you just might find yourself in an interrogation cell. There was no freedom of speech or press under the Shah, and his secret police, the Savak, was among the most feared in the Middle East. Like anyone who unironically calls themselves kings of kings, the Shah was obsessed with maintaining his power. He wasn't above using surveillance, torture, forced disappearances, and executions to do it. To be fair to this violent dictator, and I love being fair to violent dictators, the threats to his power weren't just in his head. Yes, he'd inherited the throne from his father, but both father and son owed their power in part to the Brits and the Americans. So for many Iranians, the Shah was nothing more than a puppet of Western imperialism. And as you can imagine, the Shah loved hearing people question his legitimacy. Loved it! Just kidding, he hated it and did his absolute best to crush the mounting protests against him. He even tried exiling one of the leaders of the protest movement, a charismatic Islamist named Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who's virulently anti-American, anti-Zionist, and anti-Shah sermons had captivated a wide cross-section of Iranian society. But exile did nothing to diminish Khomeini's influence. He flooded Iran with cassette tapes, remember those? Of his sermons, managing to capture Iranians' imagination even from hundreds of miles away. The Shah could read the writing on the wall. His regime was crumbling, and he was too old and too sick to fight for it. So in January of 1979, he appointed a caretaker prime minister named Shapur Bakhtiar and fled the country, a refugee king. If there's anyone in this story who I feel bad for, it's the new prime minister. Talk about being set up for failure. The opposition movement was getting louder and louder. If Bakhtiar didn't do something soon, who knew how much longer he'd have a job for? Or for that matter, a head. So he did something desperate, something a little crazy, something top secret. He turned, ready for this, to the Mossad for help. Insane. I'm trying to imagine how that conversation went. Like, what do you say when you're asking the Foreign Intelligence Service of another country to kill a political opponent? You guys do assassinations, right? Can you off this guy for me? We're dick. You know I love a counterfactual. And this is one of the most tantalizing what-ifs in Israeli history. What if the Mossad had said, yeah, we'll do it? What if they'd assassinated Khomeini, nipping the Iranian revolution in the bud? Would I still be hosting this episode, just in a slightly different form? Would Israel and Iran still be allies? Would there be some semblance of peace in the Middle East? We'll never know. Because the Mossad declined Bakhtiar's request. Not because they couldn't do it. Khomeini was still in exile in France, living out in the open. But because he was a political leader. Despite the Mossad's legend, wait for it, dairy reputation for ruthlessness and subterfuge, they're surprisingly skittish about things like killing political figures who haven't actually committed any acts of terrorism. And if you want to hear some incredible Mossad stories, check out our Mossad episode from season 3. So, here's what happened. Khomeini lived probably unaware that the Mossad had strongly considered assassinating him, and Bakhtiar, for reasons I will never understand, allowed him back into Iran. Bad move. Kind of like asking for the ball first in overtime in the Super Bowl. Too soon, 49ers fans? My bad. But anyway, within weeks, the prime minister was out of a job and on the run as Khomeini and his forces fought the Iranian army for the country. By March, it was all over. 98% of Iranians voted for their country to become an Islamic Republic. In December of that year, the so-called Assembly of Experts appointed Khomeini as Iran's supreme leader, which is a title I have to assume he chose for himself. Like, I'm just imagining the conversation. Hey, what title should I have? President? Nah. Prime Minister? Nah, we're not going to go with that. Okay, I got it. How about, like, top leader? Nope, not going to go with that. I know, supreme leader. Crazy. I love it. It's a great title on his resume. Anyway, that's a lifetime position, in case you were wondering. Seemingly overnight, Iran went from an ally of the West to its most fervent enemy. I mean, the Ayatollah had criticized the Shah as, quote, that Jewish spy, that American snake whose head must be crushed with a stone. So maybe you can see the direction things were going. His writings are an absolute goldmine of anti-American and anti-Zionist rhetoric. I mean, in a 1963 sermon, he literally said, quote, this is amazing, because of my religious obligation, I hereby warn the people of Iran and the Muslims of the world that the Holy Quran and Islam are in danger. The independence of our country and its economy are in danger of being seized by the Zionists. With the deadly silence of the Muslims, it won't be long before the Zionists destroy the existence of the Muslim nation and all its aspects. Did you know that was on the Zionist agenda? No one told me. Anyway, I could go on, but you get the point. The revolution sent shockwaves throughout the world. No one, not Mossad, not CIA, not MI6, had predicted how easily Khomeini would be able to take over Iran, and no one could predict what happened next. Okay, so it's 1979, and Iran is now in the hands of a hardline religious extremist with a serious axe to grind with the entire West, including Israel. But this wasn't the only shakeup reverberating throughout the Middle East. Less than a decade earlier, as the Shah's rule was crumbling and Khomeini was preparing his takeover, the Palestine Liberation Organization was sowing chaos too. Which brings us to stop number 2 on our long journey to understanding Hezbollah, 1960s Jordan. From its inception in 1964, the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, had one aim: get rid of Israel. Remember, this is pre-67. Gaza and Sinai belonged to Egypt. The Golan was part of Syria. Jordan held East Jerusalem and the West Bank. There was no occupation. There were no settlements. It was just Israel. And the PLO took that personally. Shout out to the Michael Jordan meme. But if the PLO, and I'm not referring to the Palestinians, I'm talking about to the leadership, the Palestine Liberation Organization, had a secondary goal, it may as well have been be a thorn in the side of every country that agrees to host us. From their headquarters in Jordan, they attacked Israel, constantly setting up training camps to teach the fine arts of guerrilla warfare. But they also found time to terrorize and extort Jordanian citizens and plot to overthrow the country's government. Remember, the PLO was an umbrella organization full of young revolutionaries, some of whom turned their energies towards chaos. Not every PLO member was kidnapping Jordanians for cash or vandalizing mosques, but the PLO's chairman, Yasser Arafat, didn't seem interested in getting his guys to calm down. And King Hussein had had enough, especially once the PLO started with the assassination attempts. By 1970, he was done. Like, civil war, crossing all dissent, kicking you all out of here, done. His crackdown was so savage that it became known as Black September. It's a wild story, and we should do an episode on it one day for sure. But all you need to know for now is this. Hussein got what he wanted in the end. He purged the PLO from Jordan, killing thousands of Palestinians in the process. So the newly homeless organization took their act to Lebanon, where they immediately resumed their old tricks of extortion, violence, chaos, and so on, which seriously did not help, because Lebanon was already full of ethnic and religious groups with serious bones to pick with one another. They didn't need the PLO coming in and inflaming things. But that's exactly what happened. By 1975, the country's simmering tensions had burst into all-out war. It was the perfect time for Ayatollah Khomeini to get involved. Yeah, remember that guy from our time in Iran? Well, he was looking to expand his regional influence, building an Islamist force loyal to him and his values, which again included a deep commitment to Islam, or his understanding of Islam, and a hatred of the U.S. matched only by his hatred of Israel. And he had identified the perfect target from which to build his guerrilla force. Lebanon's Shia Muslim minority mostly lived in poverty in Lebanon's south, neglected and ignored by the majority Christian government. They were big mad about the decades of discrimination and neglect. So the Ayatollah's forces swooped in, providing food, healthcare, infrastructure, and welfare programs. They made themselves indispensable to the Shia's social fabric. Along with the soup kitchens and mosques, they gave out something else, a vision for a different future, an Islamic future, and a Lebanon cleansed of foreign influence. It was an appealing vision, but it could only be achieved by force. Remember, war is raging. To a neglected minority group, force was not only justified, it felt essential. In a country where every day brought a fresh atrocity, it was kill or be killed. So lots of Shia men took up the Iranian offer of military training and sophisticated weaponry. They were done being kicked around, as they saw it, by the Christians and the Americans and the French and the Israelis, who raided Lebanon every time the PLO got too frisky. By 1982, many of Lebanon's Shia had joined the country's newest, highly trained, well-funded Islamist militia, which was loyal first and foremost to Iran, again, which is a Shiite country. They were now a part of the so-called Party of God, in Arabic, wait for it, you got it right, Hezbollah. Lebanon's civil war was about to get a whole lot messier. So let's recap for a second, because if my head is spinning, so is yours. I'm guessing, maybe not, but I think it is. And we haven't even gotten to the action yet. Well, we've gotten to some action, but there's more action. So check it out. Number one, there's a civil war in Lebanon. Number two, the PLO is making it much worse by encouraging sectarian divisions and launching attacks on Israel. Number three, meanwhile, Iran has been advancing its own interests by building up a highly trained Shia militia loyal first and foremost to Khomeini. And number four, all of this was about to impact Israel in a big, messy way. You might have noticed I've been remarkably silent about Israel for a while. Well, welcome to stop number four on our journey. Israel. The Jewish state spent the 1970s doing two things: recovering from the Yom Kippur War, link in the show notes, and dealing with a seemingly endless string of raids and attacks. Oh, and if pictures from the time period are any indication, wearing really silly bell bottoms. Somehow, fighting a civil war hadn't slowed down the PLO's main objective one bit. Though they were certainly keeping busy in Lebanon, they were still finding the time to mess with Israel. And the Jewish state was sick of it. Israel tried to stop the attacks multiple times, but nothing seemed to work. Not the Mossad's 1973 raid on PLO headquarters, link in the show notes, not their quiet backing of some of Lebanon's Christian militias in hopes that the Lebanese would be able to rid the country of their mutual enemy, and not their brief invasion of Lebanon in 1978 in retaliation for a horrific PLO-led massacre that left 38 Israeli civilians dead. By 1982, the Israeli public had had it up to here with PLO attacks from Lebanon. The final straw was a Palestinian ambush on Israel's ambassador to England, which left him disabled for life. 72 hours later, IDF tanks set up shop in southern Lebanon with a single goal: stop the PLO attacks once and for all. And because the PLO, well, kinda sucked as neighbors, many Lebanese actually welcomed the IDF. As Yossi Klein Halevi, the great author, recounts in his book Like Dreamers, quote, "Shiites, as well as Christians, threw rice and candies, welcoming the IDF as liberators from the hated PLO, which had terrorized southern Lebanon." But you know who wasn't happy to see the IDF roll into Lebanon? Our Iranian-backed friends, Hezbollah, who were perfectly in line with Khomeini's assertion that, quote, "We are fighting against the Western world, devourers led by America, Israel, and Zionism." And what was Khomeini, and thus Hezbollah's, ultimate goal? Quote, "We say that Israel should be erased from the world and Jerusalem belongs to Muslims." Hezbollah took up the fight against the U.S. and Israel with gusto. The first indication that Israel was dealing with a new enemy came in November of 1982 when a Hezbollah operative drove a car packed with explosives into the IDF's military headquarters in Tyre, leveling the seven-story building and killing at least 75 Israelis, not to mention a number of Lebanese and Palestinian prisoners. And Hezbollah didn't stop there. Their next major suicide attack targeted the American embassy in Beirut, claiming more than 60 lives. A few days later, President Reagan addressed the United States.
"We don't know yet who bears responsibility for this terrible deed. What we do know is that the terrorists who planned and carried out this cynical and cowardly attack have failed in their purpose. They mistakenly believe that if they're cruel enough and violent enough, they will weaken American resolve and deter us from our effort to help build a lasting and secure peace in the Middle East. Well, if they think that, they don't know too much about America."
But the attacks kept coming, each one crueler and more violent than the next. A suicide bomb at the UNRWA building in Tyre that killed 29 Israelis. By the way, UNRWA is now in the news a lot at the time of this recording, so just shout out to that reality. Two massive side-by-side bombings of American and French peacekeeping forces that claimed 305 lives.
"The gruesome search for bodies continued today. Rescue workers did in fact find more bodies, and with each discovery, the task became more painful.
The official toll now tops 160 dead and more than 180 wounded."
And more and more. Suicide bombs, rocket attacks, kidnappings, torture. This new group didn't discriminate. They kidnapped CIA operatives, Israeli soldiers, unlucky French and American citizens living in Lebanon, and Lebanese Jews who had no connection to Israel or to the wider war. Some of their hostages were later freed. Others, like CIA station chief William Buckley, were held for months and slowly tortured to death. And in the background, the war was raging. You can hear more about it in our episode on Sabra Shatila, which is linked in the show notes. By September of 1982, Israel had achieved its primary objective, getting the PLO out of Beirut. The Palestinian group decamped to Tunisia, which, random, but now Israel had a new and vicious enemy to deal with in Lebanon, Hezbollah. And they kept the attacks coming, even after Israel largely withdrew its forces from Lebanon in 1985. In fact, 1985 was a big year for Hezbollah, not just because it's the year I was born. It's also because they unveiled their official flag, which shows a hand gripping an assault rifle over the globe. Masters of subtlety, they are not. And in case anyone was confused about their aims, they also released a manifesto which laid out their objectives. To expel all foreigners from Lebanon, which is kind of hypocritical coming from a group literally founded and funded by a foreign country, but okay. To bring the Christian Lebanese political party to justice. To encourage the Lebanese people to set up an Islamic government that, quote, is capable of guaranteeing justice and liberty for all. And, of course, to destroy Israel and the U.S. too. Gotta respect that ambition. So, when the Lebanese Civil War ended in 1990, Hezbollah saw no reason to disband or disarm. After all, they hadn't achieved their goals. And for some reason that I truly do not understand, they were the only militia in Lebanon allowed to keep their weapons at the end of the war. Think about that for a second. Lebanon had just been ripped apart by a nasty civil war in which a bunch of armed groups terrorized one another, and yet the peace agreements that ended the war allowed the nastiest of these groups to keep its weapons. Friends, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say this was not good news for anyone but Hezbollah, and by extension, Iran. With their newfound legitimacy, Hezbollah started stepping up its attacks, and they were taking the show on the road. They attacked an Israeli embassy official in Turkey. They bombed embassies in London and Argentina, and one of their most unforgivable attacks, they bombed a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires, killing 85 people. Their message was clear. Nowhere is safe for you. You, of course, being Jews. The group still found time to attack Israel, raining rockets on IDF positions and Israeli cities alike, all of which came from civilian centers. A UN humanitarian aid chief called this tactic, quote, a cowardly blending among women and children. In 2024, this is a depressingly familiar bind. How does an army respond to constant attacks launched from a house of worship or a school? Like, how do they deal with that? Do you A, say screw it and bomb the heck out of civilians? Do you B, send soldiers in on foot knowing that you're condemning a certain number to a nasty death? Or C, do nothing, abandoning whole neighborhoods to their fate as target practice? These are all terrible options. So Israel went with choice D, warning civilians of upcoming strikes by peppering South Lebanon with leaflets saying evacuate. On the one hand, they were functionally warning Hezbollah exactly where they were going to strike. On the other, they were doing their best to lessen the civilian death toll. And in the meantime, the Mossad quietly, surgically assassinated Hezbollah leaders. Cutting off someone's head is a pretty good way to, you know, kill them. But the terror group just kept sprouting new heads, each one worse than the next, which is how Hezbollah got its current leader, the super fanatic cleric Hassan Nasrallah, who took power after Israel killed his boss in 1992. Maybe you've heard that name before, Hassan Nasrallah. As of February 2024, when I'm recording this, the guy is still around. I'm a big sports fan, as you know, so from a longevity perspective, gotta give him props. I mean, 92 is the year Michael Jordan and the Bulls beat Drexler and the Blazers, to give some perspective here. That's nuts. But his content, it's brutal. Turn on any of his interviews or speeches and you'll hear a litany of the anti-Semites' greatest hits. Jews are parasites and lesions on the forehead of history. The Holocaust didn't happen. Israel is a cancerous growth that needs to be removed. Really charming stuff. And just in case Israelis thought they were all talk, Hezbollah strafed Israeli towns with rockets whenever they got bored. But they really stepped up their game in the summer of 2006 when they attacked IDF soldiers patrolling Israel's northern border. Using a rocket barrage as a diversion, they managed to kill three soldiers and drag two more into Lebanon. For the next 34 days, Israel rained fire on Lebanon, eventually launching a limited ground invasion. The war destroyed much of Lebanon's infrastructure, killed over 1,000 people, and displaced hundreds of thousands more. But at its end, Hezbollah continued to exist. Though Nasrallah later admitted that he wouldn't have started the war if he had known just how intensely Lebanon would suffer, that didn't stop him from crowing about his victory. And victory is in quotation marks, just to clarify. And honestly, maybe it was a victory for Hezbollah. The war didn't dislodge him. No one forced them to disarm. And they've spent the years since preparing for another war. Lebanon is not a rich country. Many of its citizens can't even count on uninterrupted electricity throughout the day. But Hezbollah is doing great financially, like really great. Iran provides a generous $700 million allowance each year that Hezbollah has used to become better trained and better equipped than the actual Lebanese army. Those weapons include a series of tunnels snaking under Lebanon into Israeli territory. In 2018, Israel destroyed one tunnel network more than 20 stories deep, carved from solid rock and graffitied with slogans like, "On the way to Jerusalem." Attack tunnels built under Israelis' feet. Sound familiar? What is it with terrorists and tunnels, by the way? Hezbollah, Hamas, these guys love their underground infrastructure. After October 7th, we all know what Hamas did with theirs. The thought of a similar attack from Hezbollah is chilling. And it's not outside the realm of possibility. Because for nearly a decade, Israelis living on the Lebanese border have reported the sounds of digging, drilling, and construction underfoot. Imagine that for a second. You're living an ordinary life, going to the gym, picking up your kids, doing your grocery shopping, a little soul cycle maybe, knowing the whole time that a group sworn to your destruction is digging its way towards you under your very feet. Israel has destroyed some of these tunnels, but it would be naive to think they found every single one. And the threat isn't just coming from below the ground. For years, Hezbollah sent rockets towards Israeli towns. In the wake of Hamas's attack on October 7th, they've really stepped up their game. We spoke to an Israeli school teacher who lives a couple of miles from the Lebanese border, whose town was evacuated after October the 7th. After months of displacement, she decided to come back to her home, but she returned to a ghost town. There's no life here. There are no residents here. I'm very much alone on my moshav. There are no children. There's nothing. There's no city. This place is waiting for a big war. And when the war will happen, if it will happen, I won't be able to live here. But you also can't be in half of Israel because they're shelling us all the way to Tel Aviv. It's scary. It means living in fear. I'm not going to lie to you. It's February 2024 and I'm also afraid. Not for my life. I don't live anywhere near the conflict zone. But I'm afraid of what can happen if Hezbollah decides to enter the war. At the time of this recording, they haven't yet. But that can change at any minute. And that would expose Israel to a war on two fronts, Hamas in the south, Hezbollah in the north. A war with Hezbollah could be horrific, potentially costing thousands of lives on either side of the border, especially if Hezbollah manages to infiltrate Israeli territory the way Hamas did on October the 7th. Hezbollah is an extension of Iran, a proxy force that the Islamic Republic uses to attack Israel. A war with Hezbollah isn't just a war with a well-armed militia. It's a war with the entire country of Iran, which has the potential to be, in the words of Hassan Nasrallah, a fight without limits. It's a grim picture, but I'd like to believe that there are glimmers of hope. Hezbollah is hell-bent on fighting Israel, quote, until the hated ones get what they deserve. But that fight comes with a high cost for Lebanon and the Lebanese people. Remember, more than 1,000 Lebanese died in the 2006 war that Hezbollah started. Lebanese infrastructure was decimated, all because of Hezbollah's vendetta against the Jewish state. As of February 2024, Hezbollah has been shelling Israel's north and being shelled right back. Tens of thousands of civilians on both sides have been evacuated. The civilian death toll is growing, 20 Lebanese and 18 Israelis, in addition to hundreds of Hezbollah fighters. Sounds to me like there's not a whole lot in this for Lebanon. As American diplomat and former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs Jeffrey Feltman puts it, quote, Hezbollah's massive arsenal has little to do with Lebanon and serves primarily as Iran's deterrence against Israel. If Hezbollah ever has to choose between Iran and Lebanon, Lebanon becomes roadkill. And yet, a poll from January 2024 revealed that 89% of Lebanese Shia hold a very positive view of Hezbollah. In contrast, 70% of Christians and 66% of Sunnis report having a negative or very negative view of the militia. The World Bank estimates that Lebanon is in the midst of one of the worst economic crises globally since the mid-19th century. So why would the Shia, who make up a third of Lebanon's population, continue to support a group that pours hundreds of millions of dollars into arming itself while their country slides towards total economic collapse? Thought about this a lot. Why do people do things that run counter to their interests? You could ask that question about any of us, by the way. All of us make decisions that might look inexplicable from the outside, but probe deeply enough and you will find a kind of logic, even if it's logic you don't agree with. So here's what I think is going on with Hezbollah's Lebanese supporters. There are multiple types of power: the show of force, rolling in with tanks, making people do or think or believe what you tell them because they're scared of you. It works for a while, but as in the case of Iran, it can't hold forever. Then there's soft power. This is the kind of power that Hezbollah is so good at wielding at home, offering jobs and hope and opportunities. In other words, showing up, building a society. Hezbollah isn't just a militia. It's not just a terrorist group as it's described in many parts of the world, full of scary guys with guns. It's also a political party, and it occupies a central role in Lebanese politics. My association with Hezbollah is dudes with assault rifles. Your average Shia person, though, their association with Hezbollah might be their friendly neighbor, or the guy who set up the soup kitchen down the street, or the candy man at the mosque. I'm just assuming mosques, like synagogues, all have a candy man. No one correct me if I'm wrong here, please, but that's what I'm hoping. And now that things are heating up with Israel yet again, Hezbollah can yet again position itself as Lebanon's protector. It's easy to believe that Israelis are all warriors, as Nasrallah once said so charmingly, when all you know of the country to your south is shelling and cross-border raids and the growing death toll in Gaza. And look, I want to be clear. I'm not condoning support for Hezbollah, like, at all. And I think I understand how it can happen. Lebanon has powerful laws against normalization with Israel, which criminalize any contact with Israelis. You're a gamer in Beirut playing World of Warcraft, and an Israeli signs on, technically, you're not allowed to talk to them. You're scrolling Reddit from Tel Aviv and commenting in the Lebanon sub? Well, anyone who responds to you is breaking the law. That's an incredibly potent way to keep Lebanese people from seeing Israelis as fully human, as opposed to abstract conceptions. All they know about Israel is violence, and ugly stories, and bloodshed, and war, and strong military men. So of course you're going to support the group that positions itself as a defender. Ah, the power of education. And yes, I see the deep, ugly irony in the fact that Hezbollah pretends to be for Lebanon when it's literally loyal to another country. But human beings are complicated, aren't we all? Lebanon is weak, divided, and unstable. And in a country this fractious, anyone who has managed to hold on to power 40 years might be doing something right. Maybe, to some, Hezbollah is just the best of a bunch of bad options. Seems wild to me from the outside, but I'm on the outside. And that's important to remember before we start making value judgments about a third of Lebanon's people. I have to believe, though, that there's still a chance to stop whatever is coming, that Iran and Hezbollah can be convinced to draw their feet back from the fire. That's why we do this podcast, after all, in the hope that with enough education, enough stories, enough empathy, maybe things can still change. It's a slim glimmer of hope, but sometimes that's all you need to ward off the darkness. So that's the story of Hezbollah, and here are your five fast facts. Number one, in 1979, a fiery Shia cleric named Ayatollah Khomeini took over Iran and quickly started exporting his firebrand ideology across the globe. Number two, he started in Lebanon, which was in the throes of a nasty war, which involved every Lebanese ethnic and religious group, as well as Israel and Syria. Oy. Iranian forces zoomed in on the country's neglected Shia population, earning the community's loyalty. Number three, by 1985, the Iranians had built a well-trained militia loyal to the Ayatollah. This new force, which they called Hezbollah, made its name with a series of devastating terror attacks on Israeli, French, and American targets in Lebanon. Number four, even though the Lebanese civil war ended in 1990, Hezbollah did not disarm. They continued their campaign of international terror, vowing to destroy Israel. And number five, since then, Hezbollah has attacked Israel numerous times, kicking off a nasty war in 2006. And now that Israel is at war with Hamas in Gaza, it seems increasingly likely that Hezbollah is gearing up to join. Those are your five fast facts, but here's one enduring lesson as I see it. I heard a story recently that really sticks with me. It's called The Parable of the Sadhu, and it goes like this. A bunch of mountaineers from different countries are climbing Everest, because that's how some people have fun, scare the living daylights out of me, but whatever. They're all in groups, the Americans, Kiwis, Swedes, Japanese, whatever. And because they're in a super harsh environment, they've developed a kind of camaraderie, you know, warning each other when there's a steep drop ahead, stuff like that. Anyway, one of the Kiwis has forged ahead, eager to get to the top. But soon he comes back down, annoyed, carrying the body of a sadhu, or holy man. The guy isn't dressed properly, he has no supplies. On Everest, that's a death sentence. He'd clearly gotten stuck while visiting a shrine, and now he was hypothermic, close to dead. The mountaineer who had brought him down to base camp was like, I did my part. I brought this dude to base camp. Now he's someone else's problem. And then he climbs back up, ready to see the summit of this inconquerable mountain. So the rest of the mountaineers start trying to help the sadhu. They give him clothes and food and water, and he's starting to revive a little. But there's no way this dude should be on an icy, high-altitude mountain. His body has just gone through shock. He needs to be at sea level recovering. Ever been to Everest? No, me neither. But I hear it's pretty hard to climb. Going down the mountain is almost as precarious as getting up. And yet, no one wants to undo all their progress and help the sadhu get back to ground. And I get it. Everest is intense. That's what they tell me. Even groups with porters need to conserve their energy. It can be dangerous to bring the guy down and then try to get back up. And why should these groups risk their lives for a guy who hadn't been adequately prepared? Finally, someone does end up carrying the sadhu partway down the mountain, but he was still pretty high up. If he wanted to reach sea level, he'd have to fend for himself. That's essentially where the story ends, and maybe I didn't tell the story perfectly, but you get the idea. Don't you love open-ended, ambiguous tales where no one tells you what happened? Well, we don't know if the sadhu lived. We don't know the results. We know very little. We don't know how all the mountaineers felt about their choices. They were at altitude. It was cold, snowy, dangerous. They were so close to the summit, to the thing they'd been working towards and training for months or years. And after all, they did feed him and clothe him. They did carry him at least partway down the mountain. What else could they have done? What else should they have done? And in the context of this episode, who is the sadhu? Well, to me, the sadhu is morality. Doing the right thing, even when it's inconvenient. Even when it doesn't feel good. Even when it might be slightly dangerous. The mountaineers, that's all of Israel. Ordinary society, political, military leaders, regular old soldiers. Really, the Mountaineers represent anyone who has yet to make difficult moral decisions, particularly in less than ideal circumstances. In the parable, the Mountaineers are thousands of feet up. The air thin and precious. When every atom in your body is focused on survival, doing the right thing can feel like a luxury you can't afford. That's what it is to be a Jewish state among those unfriendly neighbors. Those are the circumstances under which Israeli leaders have made every decision. Parry or thrust. Choose your own soldiers over the other side's civilians. Or send teenagers into Lebanon or Gaza on foot, hoping to spare civilians, but knowing that at least some will die horribly. Respond to provocations and establish deterrence, or turn the other cheek again and again and again. And while you're making these decisions, rockets are arcing overhead. Yeah, I realize I'm mixing my metaphors at this point. The parable would have been a lot different if someone had taken charge, said, "This is unacceptable. We're going to get this guy down the mountain no matter what. We can always come back and climb to the mountain, but he only has one life." The parable would have been a lot different if the Mountaineers had actually listened to this kind of conviction. So what's the answer? How do you make these difficult moral decisions when you're at the top of the mountain? The answer is, and this is my takeaway from the parable of the Sadhu, you don't. You make them before you climb up. You make them when you can think straight, when you can feel something other than the screaming need to just survive, when you have the luxury of thinking through complex ethical questions. But that's not really how life works, is it? That's not how countries work, and that's certainly not how war works. Israel didn't want this war with Hamas. It didn't want the war with Hezbollah in 2006, and it definitely doesn't want another war on its northern border in 2024. But there's no way off this mountain, no way to stop this ride, and we all have to hope that the Mountaineers in this scenario would think carefully before they plunge us all into a multi-front war. Thank you for listening. Now it's time for our final segment, Israel Nerd Talk, where we highlight one of you, our amazing listeners. This week, meet Adil. Adil wrote, "Dear Noam, I hope this email finds you well. My name is Adil, and I'm writing to you from Portugal. This marks the first time I've reached out to a podcast host, a testament to the profound impact your show has had on me. As someone born into a mixed family with Muslim and Catholic roots, I don't hold strong religious affiliations. Nevertheless, your podcast has captivated my interest in Judaism and Israel, making me also look inward into my personal beliefs. Your work has not only educated me, but has also fostered a sense of empathy and understanding that I believe is crucial in order to reach peace in the region. May your efforts in education and storytelling contribute to a brighter, more harmonious future. Shalom, Adil." Adil, 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 I can't tell you how much I love this email, because you hit on exactly what we're trying to do here with Unpacking Israeli History. We're trying to make people look inward. We're trying to highlight all the nuances and complications of the painful and beautiful and sprawling history of Israel. And we're trying to build bridges between people by telling their stories. So thank you, Adil. Your email touched me and our whole team on a deep and personal level. And for the rest of you, I'll say as I always do, if you have thoughts, comments, ruminations, whatever to share, do not hesitate. Be like Adil. Contact me at noam@jewishunpacked.com. I want to hear what you have to say. Unpacking Israeli History is a production of Unpacked, a division of Open Door Media. Check out jewishunpacked.com for everything Unpacked related. And one more time, write to me at noam@jewishunpacked.com. This episode was produced by Rivki Stern. Our team for this episode includes Tracy Levy, Adi Elbaz, and Rob Pera. I'm your host, Noam Weissman. Thanks for listening. See you next week.